Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
And we're back. It's June 4th, 2022. 2 weeks until summer solstice. Then the days start getting shorter again. So for all you folks that are keeping up with your farmer's almanac, I don't know if there'll be a War on Christmas special this month, but we are certainly preparing for a War on Christmas during this summer of Sam. And has anybody checked on Sam Brown back down there? Did he get all that brush cut, or is he still whacking away?
So he's war. Okay, I'll have to check my alert status on him, but I think he's back in Washington D.C. Ambassador at large to world religious freedom, and he is. I think he's poking at Putin. You know, he's defending the Ukraine. Yeah. Double check, but I heard, but he's back in action again.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was reading a little bit about the family. We talked about the family before. We had some clips with Schaefer on. And, they had a bone to pick with the Wobblies going back to, like, 1921. Yeah. And so, they started Goodwill Industries.
Oh, I didn't know that. I did not know that. Huh. All this is for the viewpoint of they are, which is fundamentally white Christian nationalists. I really believe that goes for Harry in that gang in Congress who said that they were they both getting arms to Ukraine, which at this time they made a big deal about it. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think Josh Hawley, Missouri. Others. Now, and what I found disgusting was that Bernie Sanders and the so-called voted to send the 40 billion in arms to Ukraine. So it's disgust on both sides. On to me, it's like, how can you support this? And at the same time, your white Christian nationalist claiming to be anti-war? It's the first time I've ever seen him. Unless it's in the United States. I'd just as soon hang all you Wobblies, I'm sure.
We're always six degrees from some Wobbly started something.
Yeah, right.
You know, the butterfly effect.
The international globe is in their history, and forget they they're pro-life when it comes to white women, you know. That's something a lot of people see what clips we're playing tonight, but there was one out to people that so-called pro-life or anti-abortion in Kansas, like Sam Brownback. They go and point out that Adolf Hitler was for abortion, but they're totally wrong about their history because they hanged the German Nazis, Aryan white women, had abortions, and they were adamant about having gypsies, Roma, communists. Those women, they had abortions, you know, but they hanged the Aryan. So you call Hitler or the Nazis the fascist pro life, but I mean. There's a lot of pro-war, pro-life people I run. I have 40 years. They claim that they're against a woman's right autonomy over her body. And, you know, they're all about the so-called cluster of cells. But when it comes out, they're... Congratulations, you're going to war. Take your pick. You know, it could be Kuwait, Iraq. Take your pick, you know. Or I think Grenada. All these wars that have been instigated by the people of the United States, they overwhelmingly come from a perspective of white Christian nationalism. It's both sides of the aisle. That's amazing. It's totally amazing. So the Wobblies have a long history of internationalism. I remember reading about the strike with Lawrence, Massachusetts, where they sang the songs in different languages and spoke in different languages because there were so many immigrant workers who were working in these factories when the general strike took place. Very international in the composition of their strikes that went on. So, you know, I mean, that right there is a sign of danger when you have workers of all different nationalities located in Massachusetts, I believe it was, and they went out all I can communicate. You know, I think that's the danger of the Wobblies, the history of the Wobblies. But I don't know. What do you think?
I think you're right when you look at the labor movement, the anarchic labor movement, the radical labor of the 1880s and on that first 60 years. It was fueled by German, Jewish, and Italian trade workers. They got here and they were. You know, they were sweeping streets, and they realized that they had to begin to educate the proletariat and help to pull their way out, to dig out. It worked. It was powerful. It was powerful. It led up to the Haymarket Affair, and which. You know, we talked about Lucy Parsons a couple weeks ago, and her husband was executed over the, you know, there in Chicago, and there was these events that I got this real good. We should start the clips because let's go with Frank Morrow from Alternative Views down in Austin, and this was like. 1979, he's interviewing the old attorney general that tried to become a peace warrior, Ramsey Clark. You remember Ramsey Clark, don't you? From 68? You were probably on the streets in 68, right? Chicago? Mike? All right.
I'm sorry. I was muted. Yeah, he was always a mystery man to me. This federal attorney general of the United States, I think under Johnson, but where he came from, Kennedy, I can't remember, when attorney here thereafter, he was running around doing all kinds of things, opposing wars and U.S. imperialist interventions around the world for decades. And I always wondered, who the hell is this guy? You know, and he was new to me. He was sort of a man of mystery for me.
Mm-hmm.
Always involved in everything. What number is this clip? By the way, I forgot.
It's 437.
Okay. Are you ready?
Hit it, Mike.
Neil wrote that song. So
say I found an article I've been wanting to share with you for about 5 years. I lost it and only found it the other day. It's an explanation of how we've got to where we are in the housing world. As we all know, the very few of us can afford housing anymore. The percentage has dropped from 66% years ago down to just a couple of handful now. People basically, ordinary people, can't afford to buy a house anymore. Well, this is not just by accident. What happened was that it's one of the New Deal success stories. As a matter of fact, the New Deal combined a government subsidy and private enterprise to savings and loan institutions to cover otherwise risky long-term fixed-rate home loans. It took the risk out of it. Savings and loan made money. People got their homes. And the percentage of Americans owning homes rose from 44% to 66%. Well, by 1975, inflation was here, and the savings and loans could no longer make money on fixed interest 30-year mortgages. People had to pick up the tab. So the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and state legislatures obliged by a range of variable rate mortgages that rise and fall with inflation. Fall. Anybody seen any falling? Probably not. And, of course, what happened is that it shifted the burden to the homeowner, not to the savings and loan people, so they couldn't lose. Now, with an effective housing demand of 2.5 million housing units in 1980, less than half that number were constructed. And then Reagan slashed the housing subsidies and on the construction of low and moderate income housing, and so the construction of this type of housing virtually stopped in the United States and has since then. This is very pleasing to conservative economists and to Reaganites from two aspects. First of all, as some people from Brookings Institute said, the Americans are overhoused. That's their term. We're overhoused. Two-thirds of the nation owning homes is too much. And the key thing is that the capital locked up in these houses, in other words, the amount of money that people have in their homes, could better be spent for new factories and be given to the bankers so they can do with it what they want to. There were a lot of quotes along that line. Those people have, Americans have too much wealth locked up in their homes. We want that. And so that's what they did. The second aspect is that the Reagan administration wanted, and the financiers, of course, wanted a consolidation of the financial market. So that's why you see so many savings and loans being merged with others and other banks taking over savings and loans. More and more control into fewer hands. So as the In These Times article of 1981 says, the pity is that capitalism's endemic inflation has ravaged the U.S. housing industry and the New Deal public policy that supported, leaving millions of Americans in the lurch. The nation of homeowners, as we like to refer to ourselves, is producing a generation of renters permanently cut off from the traditional sources of mortgage finance and leaving it to the elite investors. Now let's have our two interviews with Ramsey Clark. First, the one that was done back in November of 1979.
There you have political economists who openly say, a man like Robert Heilbronner, who's a good man, a distinguished scholar, has a terrible problem. He's honest. He writes a book called The Human Prospect, and he says if survival is the question, then we have to ask whether democracy is possible, whether it's too slow, too cumbersome, too indecisive, whether we don't need authoritarian decision-making.
Of either the left or the right persuasion. But you know,
of my persuasion. It's always of my persuasion. But the only kind that makes
sense. This is the way the Constitution was set up. By reading the Federalist Papers, they were very preoccupied with this. And because they were concerned about the fact that the economic system placed the money and property into the hands of a few, they knew that those who didn't have it would want to get it. In addition to the things you were talking about by limiting voting and participation in government, they continuously mentioned the fact that the government must have in it flaws. It must have flaws so it cannot work efficiently. It cannot respond to any popular will might come along. So to say that democracy, even by itself, is inefficient, I'm not really sure. Maybe it is. But on the other hand, it was designed into the system we have today, and it works very well. It's worked that way to allow the economic system pretty much to work independently or with benefits of government whenever it wanted. But there were enough flaws so that people could not change the system radically and to make the popular will into popular law, as it would be, for their benefit.
Well, I agree that we began, as you say, I think John Jay, and his, who's our first Chief Justice, said it, and I think it would have been a consensus in the early years among those who were in power. Those who own the country ought to run it. That's his statement. But all the checks and balances were a fear not only of public opinion, but of government too. Wealth was afraid of the mob, and it was afraid of authoritarian government. So they're trying to fend off both sides. They've been through, they've had this problem with George III, who they didn't like, and he was authoritarian, and they'd been through the Whiskey Rebellion and Shea and all these things. They didn't like the mob. So they wanted to be protected from each. But I have to disagree when you say that democracy has been working very well. We haven't begun to practice democracy well.
No,
we don't really vote. We don't really participate. If we really participated, we'd be amazed at what would happen. Because there's a direct correlation between voting and between economic status. The rich vote 90%, the poor vote 30%. The undereducated don't vote. The overeducated, or the people who got all those degrees, are voting, and they have to reflect who they are. That's what you do when you vote. And the world as they see it, and they can't see or understand or appreciate these other people. And if they were voting to serve the others, then that's really patronizing when you think about it, or paternalistic. I know best what's good for these poor people. But even if we were all voting today, and we're far, far from it, take your last city election, take your last county election. These are people that have enormous power over your immediate life, whether your garbage gets picked up, whether your water supply is good for your children and things like that. But even if we were all voting, as we should, absolutely, this is very important. It can solve many of our problems. Money dominates politics in America, and through politics, government. And so with all of our voting, it's still who's got the paid commercials on TV. Look at the last governor's race in Texas and the multi-million-dollar per candidate cost of it. And ask yourself how the poor people are represented in that. Now, I'm poor and you're rich. I love my candidate and believe in her effectiveness every bit as much as you love yours and believe in yours. I can't give a cotton-picking dime. I don't have enough money to buy shoes for my kids. You can give money, big money, to your candidate. That's equality. That's not equality. Your candidate's going to win. You're going to have your way. I'm going to be left to struggle on with a government that I didn't choose. The roots of law are power. No question about that. Not principle, power. And the use of law historically, overwhelmingly, has been as a system of power and control. And it's still in this society used overwhelmingly that way. Our prisons are full of poor people. Nobody denies that. This state of Texas, where I was born, like my father before me, got more people in prison than any other state. The United States of America imprisons more people per capita than any Western country. Unless you consider South Africa a Western country, and we've got three Southern states that got higher per capita imprisonment rates than South Africa. And they're all poor people. When you go to law school today, you're learning the rules of moneyed might. You're studying contracts. You're studying securities law. You're studying commercial law. The law of property. People with power, economic power, which is the basic power in society. Their rules.
So actually, we still have what John Jay said should be. Those who own it, run it. When you look at the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Council of Foreign Relations, and see that these are the same people who also run the banking system, the multinational corporations, and provide the money in political action committees to have their representatives elected in Congress. It's all one ruling cartel, is it not?
Well, they don't think so, because their difference is, within the faith. There are all these little
Are they different as to strategy to rule, or are they differ as to fundamental belief systems?
No, I think they share fundamental belief systems. They're just vying for power within the narrow context.
So to what extent are those intramural squabbles even relevant to talk about?
Important to them.
Well, I mean, for us, thinking
about...
They won't
solve problems.
Okay.
No, they won't solve problems. I think the... see, even our foreign policy is clearly dominated by that, and it's tragic. A president like President Carter, who comes out with his human rights platforms, then has to have his Secretary of State say, but South Korea is off limits. We don't talk about human rights there, or the Philippines are off limits. And he calls the Shah of Iran from Camp David the Saturday before the Sunday of the announcement of the accords. But the Saturday after, the Friday that's known as Black Friday in Iran, the Friday in which thousands and thousands of people were gunned down in the streets by American-made Huey helicopters with 50-caliber machine guns firing in the crowds. And the streets are still red with blood. And President Carter calls the Shah of Iran and says, we support you, you're right. And the reason, of course, is our economic interests, our corporate, multinational oil and other business interests. And that's not any basis on which we can hope to survive on this planet. It leads to war. Respect for the rights of others is peace, as Benito Juarez from south of the border tried to tell us. And we ought to have a foreign policy that's based on that and democratic principles rather than economic power.
Ramsey, in the book here, The Citizen's Agenda, which was perhaps a statement, perhaps a Bible, during your campaign for the U.S. Senate in 76, you talk about a lot of problems here in the United States, call for a great deal of economic and political democracy, talk about who benefits, who is hurt by the system that we have now, the need for greater social services. And piecemeal, they are really substantial. But when you put them all together, if they were really effected into law, it would really call for quite a radical restructuring of the country, would it not?
Well, you know, people's reaction to the word radical is so varied. Most people, if you say something's radical, they don't want to hear any more about it. They, radical is hateful, which is kind of sad for America.
Right.
We were supposed to have been committed to the idea of individual freedom and believe in the possibility of goodness in people and change. And we were looked on as radical when we started this experiment government. I think that what I called for in that political campaign would require a profound departure from our present economic policies. I think it's absolutely essential that we recognize that. We build up to crises. Now, historically, we could do that because there was time. Things moved slowly, and usually it'd be one crisis at a time. So the crisis would come along, and we'd have this great flurry of energy finally after a lot of human suffering, and we'd address the crisis. But now we've got, a large number of major crises that are building up. Food, energy, military weaponry. And we can't wait for the energies of the people to suddenly come surging forth. There are people starving every day. The meaning of our present energy policies is disastrous for our children and deadly for our grandchildren, and not going to be good for us if we hang around very long. And we're leading up to international conflicts that can crush the human spirit, not just the body, because how do you really live with the deaths that are caused by nuclear war? I don't agree with a professor who wrote that we'd lose maybe 50 to 60 million, but the rest of the society would live normal and happy lives thereafter.
Acceptable losses, I think they call it. You know, Ramsey, it seems to me that, you know, they're drawing to sharper focus a lot of what you're saying. I think a lot of what sort of the threadbare fabric of constitutionalism, of limited government, of desire of a government which governs best as governs least, the Jeffersonian ideal, is really irrelevant in a society of tremendous economic concentration of perils which are not even immediate or directly perceived by people, like cancer in the workplace and nuclear power and decisions made in boardrooms that literally mean the lives and death to people. And you're identified with an expanded role for government. But today, government is under attack by all quarters, by liberals abandoning the ship, becoming fiscal conservatives, spouting the sort of doctrine that life is unfair and you can't expect government to solve all our problems, and of course the neoconservative movement that see this as the product of inflation, etc. Are you out of step or are you ahead of your time?
Well, I'm out of step. We'll have to wait to see whether I'm ahead of my time.
All right, we're back. It's the abolitionist hour. It's 7:35 p.m. in the Midwest. And we were listening to After Midnight. And that was who was the guy? Hank Wilson had the album. Hank Wilson? Leon Russell?
Is that 1972?
Yeah, yeah. So I always wondered, what does that mean? It's like, okay, Neil Young had Hank Williams' guitar, but Leon Russell had Hank Williams' belt buckle.
Oh.
I mean, there's this old gray guy with gray long hair, premature gray, and strumming a guitar to a crowd, and then it says Hank on the on, and that's the album cover. Hank Wilson's back.
Hank Wilson.
So, all right, I've got to get to the meaty stuff. Now, Alex Jones is in trouble. He goes to a defamation court battle on September 1st, and he's virtually wiped out. And so he's got problems. He's going back to the old school Alex Jones that we liked 30 years ago, talking about spaceships landing and stuff. Well, this time he's threatening cannibalism of his neighbors. And so this is 4:35.
Okay.
That's why I was asking you about gardening.
Hit it, Mike.
Thank you. I'm not letting my kids die. I'm just going to be honest. My superpowers being honest, I've extrapolated this out, and I won't have to for a few years since I got food and stuff, but I'm literally looking at my neighbors now and going, I'm ready to hang them up and gut them and skin them and chop them up. You know what? I'm ready. My daughters aren't starving to death. I'll eat my neighbors. See, my superpower is being honest. I'll eat your ass. I will. I'm combat model, optimum self-sufficiency, probably the leader. The point is have you thought about that yet? Because I'm somebody that thought I could fix this, and I'm starting to think about having to eat my neighbors. You think I like sizing up my neighbor, how I'm going to haul him up by a chain and chop his ass up? I'll do it. My children aren't going hungry. I will eat your ass. And that's why I want the globalists to know. I will eat your ass first.
That was just John from InfoWars. He wouldn't give his last name, but he is armed to a T. He has a what looks like a large rifle on him.
There's good folks that wear blue. You know, there's folks that slip into it like any other occupation that probably don't need to be doing it. But as far as making judgment calls on things that courts have decided, that's part of the process is having a thing adjudicated and everybody going okay. You know, everybody's got their day in court. But like I said, everybody is entitled to their opinion, but they're not entitled to make up their own facts and then to agitate and try to bring about confusion and harm to property or people.
The gentleman that was just standing here, he asked, how are you able to open and carry that rifle?
Open carry is open carry.
Can you break it down for me, please? Can you elaborate on that?
I'm not an attorney. I'm happy that we're able to defend ourselves. It's been our right for a long time, and various states have finally come online and finally acknowledged that that's what the people want.
Right.
We lose our ability to have a say-so in how things are run when we don't have the means to say no. And that's where we're headed. We've run into, sadly, an administration that forces things down our throat, that they don't represent our interests.
Do you recognize that if the average Ferguson protester armed themselves the way that you've armed yourself, that they probably would be targeted?
It might invite some problems.
And why is that?
Well, once again, it's how things are perceived. It's how things are perceived. I follow the concept, but like I said, all lives matter. It's all lives matter. I'm upset about abortion. This latest thing with Planned Parenthood, it gets my panties in a wad. It's sad that not only do they kill life, but then they harvest it out for a fee. I explain it to the best of my ability. All lives matter. All lives matter. I don't care whether you're pink or blue. It's all lives matter.
But do you feel more emphasis needs to be put on the Black Lives Matter movement at this present time? All lives matter. We get that.
And so
do you feel at this point in time that a little bit more emphasis needs to be put on Black people?
Let me explain it this way. If all the crime was reported that's leveled at various groups, whatever the color of their skin, people would be appalled.
Right.
They would be appalled.
Did you explain that?
I explain myself. All lives matter. All lives matter.
All cancers matter?
You know, it's kind of a moot point. All lives matter. You know, I understand everybody is upset.
But the question is,
has
been hurt.
Are you going to go into a diabetes fundraiser, a diabetes function, and say all diseases matter? Or is it going to be...
Of course we want to cure all disease.
So can you, do you understand the root of the Black Lives Matter thing?
You keep going back to this question about why Black lives matter more than white lives or yellow lives.
Well, the DOJ basically put out a report saying that African-American people were targeted here, that the courts here were making all types of money on Black people.
And I did follow that. And
my question,
were released
a lot of people's question really is, do you think that African-Americans here really need to be looked at more? The lives that they're living, the criminalization of African-Americans in Ferguson, should that be an issue? Because that's what Black Lives Matter is talking about. While all lives matter, Black people in Ferguson, according to the DOJ, were targeted.
I believe they probably were put in a position where they were not able to come up with fees leveled against them, and there did seem to be a systematic abuse of the court system's power, and I understand some folks were let go because of that.
And what's the solution now?
The solution is definitely not violence. It's definitely not violence. It's having a spokesperson that's eloquent, expressing your all's views. We have a mulatto president. I don't know about Eric Holder's background, but if there was ever a chance to resolve some issues, it would seem that it would be during this administration.
Who are you here to protect?
InfoWars, I've said before, are here. They're documenting the activities, and we're here to keep them safe. As far as training, not only have I received excellent training at the city, county, state, federal, and international levels, but I'm a trainer. By the grace of God, so far, we've managed to dodge a lot of bullets. Accidents always happen, and so far we've remained fairly accident-free as far as any kind of a misunderstanding or mix-up. We're all about the Constitution.
So again, John, I mean, do you advocate people of Ferguson arming themselves in a similar manner? I mean, if you're out here...
What would be the purpose of them arming themselves? Previously, reporters have been set upon, they've been hurt, they've been knocked to the ground, their stuff stolen.
Okay.
We're here just to make sure that they're left alone so they can record things. I'm John. That's sufficient. DOJ said that we are domestic terrorists. Law enforcement did, whether it was the Highway Patrol or it was all under the instigation of the Department of Justice.
Let me ask you this. What do you think about
all lives matter, sure.
Mulatto president, as you described him, what is your feeling on that?
Well, we could get into issues about his biographer and his wife and he himself before he attained to that office, talking about having been born in Kenya. So all of a sudden that's no longer an issue, and the Democrats and Republicans all went along with it. You know, he's a very intelligent man.
Do you think he's a secret Muslim?
You know, the ring that he wears, it appears to be some type of Muslim ring. So we're here with InfoWars to make sure that they stay safe.
Okay,
and
so
previously reporters have been hurt and their things stolen.
So
they're not exploiting, they're just trying to record what's going on so the people can decide for themselves.
So you said you're here with InfoWars, correct?
I'm here with Oath Keepers protecting the folks from InfoWars.
We're back. It's 7:50 p.m., the Abolitionist Hour. That was Tony Levin on bass, Robert Fripp on guitar, Bill Bruford on drums. So that was a King Crimson trio live in Japan. And before that, talking was Joe the Oath Keeper from the St. Louis County Sheriff's Department. And he was fired shortly after that. But during Ferguson, they were bringing in lobbyists to basically to sell Bushmaster AR-15s to police departments in Missouri. And so they kind of cloaked it as, well, you can't travel from one county to the other because gun laws are different. And the next thing we knew, they were down there. They didn't. They really thought that you know, everybody in Ferguson had like 3 arrest warrants from all the fines and things that were being issued in Ferguson, and they were buying. They were building brand new courthouses and jails and things in these jurisdictions where you have like 90 small towns that comprise of St. Louis County, and so you'll have towns of 300 people that have been 99.9% white since 1850, and then right next is like places like Ferguson. And so once this message got out, once a couple Quick Trips were set on fire, then people started taking a look at what was going on in St. Louis and realizing it was across the country. We have 17,000 prosecutors, jails, 600 prisons, a couple more hundred federal prisons. And this was built on the backs of oppression, and there had to be pushback, and that's what we saw, and then the second person that was shot had a phone in his hand, so that would have been about 90 days after Mike Brown was killed. And then there was a kid, or he was a kid at the time. I think he was, you know, in his teens, but he was charged with arson there at that Quick Trip, trying to I don't remember it was dark at the time, but anyway, Josh is still in prison, and so there's a big campaign to do letter writing for Josh Williams and to support the fact that he was singled out and in his own right he became a political prisoner also. So Mike, did that tell you enough about the Oath Keepers in St. Louis? Do you remember that story?
I saved it, but
I was trying to find the one where he was doing a speech in a gymnasium, and it was just off the charts wrong, you know, and so it was Oath Keepers in their own words, and then of course, you know, it was funny because he was saying, yeah, we've had very few Oath Keepers have had very few accidents. Well, the leader of the Oath Keepers lost an eye because a gun misfired and blew up in his
right. And he's, isn't he Yale educated? He's an Ivy League
yes.
Lawyer.
Yeah, his wife and kids escaped, you know, and for their lives in recent months, and yeah, so we're seeing a few things coming apart. You know, I'm going to do this thing about cat curfew. This is 4:33. Okay, so gentrification in Iceland. People are waging war against feral cats. And then there's a little news bulletin we're going to break in there. But and I think we got Curtis Mayfield on this also. So that's 4:33. Hit it, Mike.
Did he go wrong, my love? We've planned and worked hard from the very start. Tried to make him better than all the rest, but the brother proved to be so much less. Everybody's friend, but sometimes you wonder now and then. The only time he chooses you when there's something to lose through his personal loss. And the friend pays the cost all the time. Must be something that's freezing his mind that has made him through grief so very blind. I don't think he's gonna make it this time.
Hawkeye Magazine explores science, society, and the environment from a coastal perspective. Today's feature article is, It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your cat is? In Iceland, traditionally a land of cat lovers, bans and curfews are redefining the human relationship with domestic cats. Few wild animals consciously opt for a domestic life. At the dawn of agriculture, the cat agreed to kill a few rodents in exchange for leftovers and, assuming ancient cats are as somnolent as modern cats, places to nap for 12 to 18 hours of the day. Yes, cats played social companions to needy humans in ancient times. Killing a cat was punishable by death in ancient Egypt, but their role was farm work. And this wonderful arrangement lasted, roughly speaking, for 10,000 years. Now, we want them to stop. Surveys suggest Icelanders' support for cat curfews is highest in regions with private homes and private gardens. Their reasoning is predominantly idiosyncratic, likening roaming cats to visits from rowdy town drunks. To paraphrase some online comments about cat visitations, cat urine sprayed the patio, challenged another cat to a 3 a.m. duel and killed the yellow daffodils. Last week he came into the house and the pharmacy is out of pet allergy drugs. Cat supporters rely along the lines of, get a life and try to tolerate the outside world. Cats are a delight and have roamed Iceland as long as we have. The ecological impact appears secondary to public policy, evident when Husavik, made famous by the Netflix comedy Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire saga, became one of the first European towns to impose a total cat curfew. Back in 2008, the debate began when a local feral, domesticated and unowned, population became troublesome, perhaps because their population hit a tipping point. Cats get pregnant as early as 4 months old, with 1 to 6 kittens per litter. A single female can get pregnant 3 times a year and have over 150 descendants within 2 years. The growing band of unowned cats in Husavik began to hang out next to a fish farm by the edge of town, snacking on land-grown char. At the same time, a happy accident for the cats, a geothermal drilling project's runoff water created a permanent wetland for coastal birds to nest in. Spring came, nesting began, trouble started. Studies in the United States suggest feral cats cause some 70% of bird mortality, which is blamed on cats in general. The obvious solution to these Husavik bandits would have been to cull unowned cats and, further, ban all felines in rural parts of the municipality with the largest nesting sites. That would have upset farmers. Instead, local people, who seem to largely oppose cats as nuisance animals, used the opportunity to impose a cat curfew solely within town limits. Minja von Schmalense, an expert on invasive species at the West Iceland Nature Research Center, says the ongoing cat wars are often based on idiosyncratic preferences, not science. There are places where feral cats should absolutely be banned outside, if not cats entirely, she says. In other words, such bans are overly drastic. My worry is that each community will follow the loudest group regardless of the facts.
Every two-hour review, the lieutenant should give the prisoner an opportunity to use the toilet unless the prisoner is continuing to actively resist or becomes violent while being released from restraints. Even though he was displaying signs of self-control, Mr. King was placed into a hard four-point restraint at 2 p.m., and he remained in the hard four-point restraints until he was placed into soft restraints. At 4 p.m., the lieutenant restraint check noted the staff were ordered by captain not to speak with inmates and that Mr. King did not request the use of a toilet. At 4:30 p.m., notes say that Mr. King is to remain in hard four-point restraints until the rights have been read. At 6 p.m., entirely repeats the information written at 4 p.m., stating that Mr. King should remain in restraints until his rights were read. Literally, the closet analogy of the rack. The force and restraints officials used in response to the alleged assault of another officer was cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment and Bureau policy, and clearly applied maliciously and sadistically for the very purpose of causing harm, destruction and falsification of evidence, misconduct by law enforcement officials in collecting incriminating evidence may rise to the level of a due process violation when the misconduct is outrageous enough to shock conscience of the court. King motioned to dismiss outrageous misconduct. BOP officials chose not to capture and or later destroy video of Mr. King behaving calmly and non-combatively while being held on the ground, transported in a restraint chair, and transferred into the SHU. The destruction of the apparent exculpatory evidence in violation of due process, which says that calculated use of force shall be videotaped following the sequential guidelines presented in the Correctional Services Manual. At least 2 hours of video depicting Mr. King in hard four-point restraints is not accounted for. Documents show that Mr. King was in hard four-point restraints from 2 p.m. to 7:25 p.m. The government provided approximately 300 minutes of video, in addition to the conscious shocking storage room encounter and restraint torture sequence. The government obstructed Mr. King's relationship with his attorney, BOP Attorney Special Assistant United States Attorney Wynick, on the morning of August 20, 2018. Mr. Wynick acts deliberately intruded with and obstructed Mr. King's ability to access counsel. Mr. King was further prejudiced by these acts because the government was able to obtain admission from him in spite of asking the assistant detectives Erb and Silva without the possibility of speaking to an attorney. This interference with Mr. King's ability to communicate with counsel is offensive to the notion of due process, and the court should dismiss the indictment due to this misconduct alone. Conclusion: the collective action of Lieutenant Wilcox and other BOP officials who assaulted Mr. King and participated in the investigation of this matter shocked the conscience, violates the decencies of civilized conduct, are too close to the rack and screw to permit constitutional differentiation, and ultimately offended the sense of justice. Mr. King makes this request because the ongoing course of misconduct in this matter participated in serious prejudice to Mr. King's legal right to due process, legal rights to be free from excessive force and cruel and unusual punishment. To sanction the brutal conduct such as this displayed by officers at FCI Florence in this matter would be affordably brutal to cloak of law. To vindicate the community's sense of fair play and decency and avoid discredit law and thereby brutalizing the temper of a society, Mr. King requests that the court dismiss the indictment, dated September 13, 2021.
Sure.
We're back. It's 8.09 p.m. in the Midwest. We've got to have peace. And I was reading a little bit from Eric King's court case, and he's got a civil rights case that's working, and the story is of his torture out in Florence Federal Prison in Colorado. It's the story's gone international, so he's got Human Rights Commission looking into it, and so it happened. The 2018 prison strike went on in about 20 states, maybe 25 prisons shut down. 25, roughly 25,000 prisoners, as far as we know, and we never know how many prisoners die as a result of these strikes. But we do know that more prisoners are dying for striking than any other sector in North America. And he was in solitary confinement for 3 years. If you go to Unicorn Riot Ninja, there's a phone interview with Eric that was just posted this weekend. And it was his experience in the courtroom after 3 years of solitary confinement, and then the first humans that he saw were these attackers. And their testimony, he's just describing them how they seem so small, after all that time in solitary. But anyway, check out Unicorn Riot Ninja. There's a lot of good stuff there. And it also, It's Going Down is another source for a lot of your grassroots news. And there's some cat issues going on in Iceland. The cat curfew. Okay, so go to 436. We're going to go to John Houseman, and you all may recognize some of the folks out here recognize the name John Houseman, but it's on Dave Letterman when he was with CBS. So this was 1982, and what's interesting about the old Dave Letterman show was it was a bare bones writing staff, and everybody wore many hats and things, and so things didn't always go as planned. But this was 4:36, and I was trying to find John Ashcroft, and John Houseman come up is exactly how I found this clip, and so it's kind of like Google Bingo or something. So anyway, 4:36, hit it, Mike.
This is a song written by my friend Lowell George. I've been walked by the rain, driven by the snow, I'm strong and dead. Don't you know what I feel? Thank you. been kicked by the wind, robbed by the sleet, had my head stove in, but I'm still at my feet and I'm still
and gentlemen, I call you ladies and gentlemen, but you know what you are. Now, if you were the competent studio audience you so presumptuously claim to be, you would have laughed uproariously at my little quip. That is why I'm here, to teach you to be a decent studio audience. You may wander in here, a callow, untried neophytes, leave as fully accredited, highly skilled audience. Remember, you are to laugh and applaud at anything, no matter how puerile or inane or foolish it is, or you will not leave at all.
Thank you very much. My name is David Letterman. Good morning. Welcome to our show. And for the first half hour this morning, we're going to have a discussion about people who work for companies that make elevators. And and then a little later, we got a guy from Great Neck who turned in a wonderful sign earlier, and we have a fine show for you folks this evening. You've come on a... Is it still raining outside? Is it raining nasty or just sort of, just... You folks would rather not be messed with. That's the deal, isn't it? We got a great show for you, and I'll tell you all about it in a second or two here. But first of all, I have to explain something to you. I am steamed. Okay, 60 Minutes, the big-time TV show, Sunday night. Everybody watches Mike Wallace, Morley Safer, and the boys push people around. I'm at home Sunday night watching the show. I time it. 57 minutes, 30 seconds. Take away the commercials, 51:30. Anybody have any questions before we... okay, great. That's just as well. We got a great show. You all already saw one of our guests this morning. John Houseman will be out in a moment or two. And Jake LaMotta, the Raging Bull, is here in person tonight. A gentleman who makes his living selling things that you don't normally buy in stores or wherever else you go to buy things. I don't know. We'll find out from him. He's a pitch man. His name is Dave Clark. He'll be joining us. Oh, now here's something. If you're considering going to sleep, just forget it. And that goes for you folks in the audience. And you guys in the control room. Tonight, a report on celebrities and their business machines. It's unbelievable, trust me. And in addition to all this, as if this were not enough, we have a very special guest coming up in the, what do you say, second half hour of the extravaganza. And by extravaganza, I mean this. What are we doing? Is that, have I taken care of the business we need to take care of? Anyway, you folks are here on a terrific night. Thank you very much for coming. And these gentlemen, by the way, are not with the show. You're witnessing a crime. My, what a festive array we have here. You know, maybe you're not aware of this, but every year research departments of major food production companies get together and try to come up with new ideas for foods. And there's a big convention and a show here in town, New York City, and they're showing now products that will be on the market in a couple of weeks, and we have a few of them. This one's nice. Let me just place this over here. This is from the folks who developed Styrofoam. Now comes packing meringue. Yes, it's a durable, lightweight packing material and also a tasty, lightweight dessert. So you can actually eat this stuff. No, not too bad. Uh-huh. I'm looking for number two. Has anyone... Here's number two right here. Oh, this is the newest frozen food sensation, toaster peas. To brighten up those vegetarian breakfasts, these toaster-sized frozen blocks of peas are ready to eat. Just pop them in the toaster, and in just a few minutes, you have peas. Oh, no. Boy, this stuff is tastier than you might think. Number three. There's number three right here. Oh, this is nice. This is a new holiday sensation, oyster eggs. Brightly colored oysters brought to you, of course, by the Oyster Bunny. And here we have them right here. See the oyster eggs, and there they like that. Okay. Maybe a little, maybe a little too festive. Now here, for the hungry commuter, wallet-sized cold cuts. Oh, this is nice. See, it comes in a wallet like that. Like to see a picture of the family right here next to the spam, okay? That was number four. Now we're looking for, oh, number five. This is great. You all, of course, know all about the Gouda cheese. This is the Gouda yo-yo. This is... There it is.
It doesn't work.
Okay. Some of the folks in the audience having a little too much fun. Gouda cheese. There we go. Number six. Are we up to number six? Fortune pudding. Oh, this is terrific. It's hoped that this novelty delight will replace the dull old-fashioned fortune cookie as America's new fun dessert. And, of course, you just eat down through there and fish out your fortune. There you go. Well, it's a little blurred. I'm sorry, but you get the idea. Now, number seven... Oh, this is a great combination. It's the newest sensation to hit from Denmark as a result of that country's cycling craze and their recent ham surplus. It's the meat seat. Tell the truth, have you ever seen anything more disgusting on American TV? All right, and finally, have we got time for this one? The miracle of modern science brings you the newest dessert craze of the 20th century, the radio-controlled sweet roll. No need to go out for dessert when dessert can come to you, and we'll put this down here like that, turn it on, and turn it on, and turn it on, and, well, I think you can pretty much get the idea. Let's just assume now for a second that the studio was built on about a 30-degree angle. Oh, unbelievable, isn't it? It's the kids' soccer. Yes, it's worked swell a minute ago. New products that will be on the market in a couple of days. Coming up next on this program, John Houseman. Good morning and welcome back to the show, and what a show it is indeed. In theater, film, and more recently television, John Houseman is a man for all seasons. He's most recognizable for his role as Professor Kingsfield in the movie and the television version of The Paper Chase, as well as some highly visible TV commercials. But his theater and film career as a renowned producer and director is legendary. Would you please welcome Mr. John Houseman. Thank you very much. Nice to see you, and thank you for opening our show. That was very nice. You played the part of Dr. Kingsfield in the movie The Paper Chase and later the TV show, and you won an Academy Award for that. But the television show was not the runaway hit of the decade, as they say, was it?
It ran a year, yeah.
Why wasn't it more successful?
It was not more successful because it only played to about 18 million people a night.
Mm-hmm.
And Laverne and Shirley played to about 30 million.
Mm-hmm. You don't think it ought to be that way, eh?
I don't have any feelings about it. I don't really wish to compete with Laverne and Shirley. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, even if you beat them, I mean, that's a...
I don't think that's my métier, no.
Yeah, yeah. You weren't the original choice for that part in the film, huh?
Well, originally, I think James Mason was intended to play it, and then he got stuck in Spain, and then they thought of a lot of other famous actors, and finally, in sheer disgust and despair, they hired me.
Disgust and despair, eh? Now, you had a lengthy career in motion pictures, but not as an actor, right?
That's right, as a producer.
Yeah, and what kind of projects were you involved that we would be aware of?
Well, you were a very small boy, probably, when some of them were done. The Bad and the Beautiful, Executive Suite, Letter from an Unknown Woman, Lust for Life, Julius Caesar.
Lust for Life? Mm-hmm. Who was in Lust for Life?
Well... Van Gogh and Gauguin and a lot of people.
We have a piece of film, I guess, of you in action as a director. Now, you want to do that now? You want to take a look at that? Okay, let's take a look at that now. Do you know what this is?
Yes, it's a piece of a very interesting film. It was made about 2.5 years ago, and it was made during the direction and production of... King Lear by the acting company, of which I'm one of the artistic directors, and I directed the piece. And it's a very interesting documentation of how a classical play gets put on.
Okay.
To have 1,000 with red burning spits, come hissing in a puddle, the foul fiend bites my back.
It shall be done. I will array them, say, come, sit thou here, most learned justice, and thou sapient sir,
sit here now.
You played it like Humpty Dumpty. You were falling over on yourself. You were anticipating the mad scene in the third act. He's still...
The third heat scene.
No, all the heat scenes. You were really tumbling around and waving your arms like windmills. It was very peculiar goings-on. You've never done it before that way. It was all sort of... And flapping your hands like a... Flapping your hands like a seal.
Caramon doesn't pay him for nothing.
We need to interrupt. John Houseman is here. We just saw you directing folks in King Lear, and you, for the most of your theatrical career, were a director and a producer.
That's
and
right.
How did you become an actor?
Somebody asked me.
Uh-huh. So that's the way it works? But after all of those years of instructing people, as we saw, it never occurred to you that maybe you could do it or wanted to do it? Or
no.
Were you just thinking to yourself, I'll wait till someone asks?
No, never occurred to me.
Yeah. In the book, we had Francis Ford Coppola on last night. And he was talking a little bit about Marlon Brando.
Mm-hmm.
You have a connection to Marlon Brando also, huh?
Yeah, a long time before.
Yeah.
Because my experience was quite different. I gather that... in Coppola's picture, he was looking around for cue cards and bits of paper on the backs of chairs.
Mm-hmm.
He played Antony for me in Julius Caesar, and he was not like that. He came letter perfect. He had one of the longest speeches in the English dramatic repertory, and he knew it word for word before he started.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave us a wonderful performance.
Was it a fight for you to get him into the production?
Well, they thought I was crazy at first, yes.
Why did they think...
Well, because they knew him principally because of Streetcar.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that the way he spoke English was when he said, Stuart! Mm-hmm. And they thought he'd play Antony a little bit the same way.
Yeah. Not many Shakespearean characters named Stella, I don't think, it turns out.
I'm trying to think. I don't think so.
Let me ask you a question or two about Orson Welles. And you had an association with him years and years ago. And
it's a long association, about 6 years.
Yeah. But after that, it sort of came apart, right?
Well, like all partnerships, we were very close for 6 years, and then we drifted apart.
Let me read a couple of... Actually, there's three things in your book, and you can comment on any of these three things. Welles hurled a dozen cans of Sterno at you in a fancy restaurant.
Only three.
Okay. Three cans of Sterno. In Julius Caesar, which you directed, Welles used a real knife and stabbed the actor playing Caesar.
He was directing it himself, mm-hmm. and he did use a real knife, and by accident, he did spike the man who was playing Julius Caesar, mm-hmm. and it was touch and go there for a while. Mm-hmm. Because being a good actor, he lay there in his own blood mm-hmm. Until the scene was over.
Uh-huh.
And then it was almost too late.
Yeah. That takes the fun out of theater work, doesn't it?
No, they enjoyed it.
The final one here is, Welles once accused you of trying to poison him with dry ice.
That's true. I mean, it's true that he accused me.
Oh, you did not?
And I did feed him dry ice, but I did know that it was harmless.
Oh, you thought it just something funny to pull on Orson?
No. It was, he had to hold a tankard full of steaming wine, and the prop man came and asked me, and I said, the only way I know to do it properly is with dry ice.
A little dry ice.
And he did, and Orson was convinced that he was being murdered.
John Houseman, thank you very much for being here tonight.
We have to pause. We'll be right back.
Keep your eyes on the road that you're headed.
And we're back. It's 8:35 p.m. And that was the lovely Linda Ronstadt from 1976, back when she was still doing the Patsy Cline covers. So we're going to move on to hip-hop. And the history of hip-hop is really interesting because now we've got 40 years of the development. And so I came across this story I thought was pretty interesting. And I know we got people from the Inglewood Free School. They're working in the kitchen for their breakfast program over at King and 64th in the South Side of Chicago. And so I thought they would probably like this story while they're sitting there stirring and mixing and baking and doing all the prep work for tomorrow. And this one's 4:32, and so it starts with Mr. D.O.G., who became Mr. Dog, and he became an artist and producer. And so he talks about his struggle. And so there's an interesting thing. They're talking about, like, him putting out mixtapes and greatest hits and anthologies and things. It's like he's put together 50 touring acts and moving them around the country, and things go wrong. And sometimes as a tour manager, you get caught up in the middle of these things, and you have to sit down. He describes it as sitting down. And so there's been several times over the past 25 years, he's done a year and a half in the state pen. And the way he supplemented his income is that he would put out a mixtape or an anthology. He produced over 50 acts, and so he still had a record company that he just ran it out of the prison. And so it's really good, and it's somebody you probably have not heard of. And so here he is, Mr. D.O.G., and it's 4:32. Hit it, Mike. The notorious Oklahoma, them hills not free. Take a walk through my street, but you might get dragged down. The homies posted on 19 with the blue flag down. Set a murderer mayhem, big wheels and fly rips. Dead ends with dead ends, good hoes working for you. Don't let me play in this boss and don't come around often. We can know when you talk and get measured for you. Listen to the homies, don't play that shit. We got itchy trigger fingers, let the egg hit you. Around here, it's a straight mask for the trigger. So cool. Like Mr. Gold Camilla, the little locals are looking for a little bit of nothing. We hungry out here, living on chicken and meat. So when you come to the tank, then respect the fact. They catch black when they try to get me here. Make your body, and at the age of 13, little loafers is out here walking. Blue rags in their left pocket, blue strings in their cup. Personal murder block, serving cream to the cup. All about they deal with 9Zs in their neck. With riders on the lookout, and that's what's up. This is the hood that they warned you about. For rims and stone, cars get jacked, and out of towns get bound. Home. The hood where they get wet and throw darts at popo. Get this out there, but they deserve that armor. When my ninjas roll SUVs on Deuce Cole. TVs in the head, that's what Lambo does. With old school, with drop top, even though it always rains. From up across the big old hall, from Zayn to when OCD was ATB, when the OCD
hospitals, man. My dudes kept it 100 from day one. You know, there's a lot of pesky new generation dudes out here putting black guys in the gang, making their mouths sound like airplanes till it's time to fly. Get your weight up, man. Southside.
A lot of guys in other places have had the luxury of being, you know, this is all Atlanta made, this is all New York made, this is all LA made, this is all Miami made, you know. So it's beautiful that you're able to, you know, put out a predominantly Tacoma produced project, man. Who are some of the young up and comers that you're looking at that you would kind of say are, you know, kind of the standouts right now coming out of the tech?
My dude wasn't messing with for years, who's doing this thing. He's on Black Umbrella Records with Raz Simone and King Lee's. He used to go by Lee Soprano, mm-hmm. And of course I told you he was on my album before. He's on this one here right now, and he's doing this thing. He just did a show, I think, last month in Hawaii with Blueface.
Mm, okay.
So, but he's out here doing his thing. You gotta say Louis of MKS.
Mm, oh yeah.
Yeah, he's doing his thing, you know what I'm saying? He just did a little nationwide tour with Lil Mosey, and his little song Driver was actually killing him, and he got a new single coming out now. His whole little unit, MKF, is actually trying to make some noise, did piano on him, just making some noise. My dude Block Rep Shot, killing the game right now. He's featured on a lot of stuff. He just did a feature. Like, we got a video coming out right now, the song with me, him, and Glass Malone. Then he got a video that just came out with him and Lizzy Soprano, and that goes hard, too, over at J.P. Bang's beat. He also got an album that just came out with Cashier. And so, I mean, that's pretty the main dudes. You got Taz Jones who kind of doing his thing with the Juggalos. And
okay.
There's quite a few cats. I could probably talk you here off about. We got a lot of talent here right now. We got some dudes who are really big on the battle circuit too.
Okay.
So like Stewie Newton, you got a talented Real Cosby. K&M was doing the battle thing for a minute, and they up and coming. I mean, we got a lot of talent, bro. A lot of talent.
Yeah, that's great, man. And I'm glad now. You know, it's on one degree, it's like, man. We've kind of always had a lot of talent, you know what I mean? But I feel like we probably haven't always had the right outlets, you know, the right connections, things of that nature. But it's good now that, you know, we're in a position where, you know, we got OGs like you that could help open the door up and help, you know, give young brothers that's on the come up a push in the right direction, you know what I mean? To help give them their shine with your well-established fan base for over two decades now, you know what I'm saying? That's a very well established fan base. So for you to give brothers the opportunity to hop on, you know, your project and be a part of that and get your co-sign, man, I know that means a lot. You know what I'm saying, to the young up and comers, man. You mentioned Black Rep Shad, which of course you already know. That's he's always been one of the coldest rappers from Tacoma to me, in my opinion, man. So I'm glad to see him rocking and rolling.
And I gotta tell you one more name too. I can't leave a little homie out, because our new song on my new project coming up is Murder and Stuff. My dude Purge Team Mees.
Okay.
Yes, and if you ain't heard of him, you'll be hearing about him soon. He's chewing stuff up right now. He's bananas right now.
Okay. Beautiful, beautiful. And that's good too, because we ain't got a lot. Like nowadays, it ain't even about niggas chewing stuff up no more. Like that's not even going on. You know what I'm saying? So when you hear somebody that is, it's always refreshing to hear people that's actually valuing bars, you know what I mean, actually valuing lyricism, you know what I mean, because that's a neglected art form, you know, at this stage in the game. And then, of course, you know, the little MKF, brothers from the MKF conglomerate, you know what I mean, I've been paying very close attention to, you know, what they got going on, man. They got a lot of good stuff going on, man. Yeah, okay. So, man, is there anything in closing anything in closing you want to say, man? We've been rocking and rolling damn near 2 hours, man. It's been a beautiful. I appreciate you, you know, for this, man.
Yeah, man. First of all, if you ain't got it, make sure y'all go check out that Awakening. It's on every digital platform available out there. You can also go to a website, bwr2000.com, and get that joint. You can buy it off my Facebook page, The Real Mr. DOG. Check out the videos on YouTube. We got a lot of projects in the work. We got that top of the long awaited top of the food chain with me and my longtime brother Mac Money about to come out. I got my new album that we're working on right now, and definitely gonna be my best piece to date. The Curator, that's coming out, and then we're also working on the Best of DOG.
Okay. That sounds good. The Best of, that's gonna be great.
Yeah, but it's called Louis the 13th.
Okay.
It's the expensive. It's the best. It's the top show.
Oh yeah. That's beautiful, man. Well, definitely, man. Again, I appreciate it, man. Keep grinding. I ain't got to tell you, keep grinding. You're gonna keep grinding regardless, man. You know what I'm saying? So, you know. But definitely, again, man, I appreciate you, brother, man. Of course, with you, man. The most blessings. Best of luck.
All right.
Back in the old days.
Yep.
If you listen to the blues recordings from the 20s, which I love, you can say that Sunhouse is playing an E7th or a dominant chord or whatever. He's just making sounds, and
right.
Sometimes he's playing the guitar with a knife. You can sort of say that they're chord changes, but they really aren't.
Right.
He's working within a context of sounds that have no counterpart in Western culture. And so you had this amazing moment where 2,500 years of tradition in the West of playing in tune were challenged directly, and it forced a whole new way of dealing with music. And the first innovations were jazz and blues.
Yep.
But then it spread into every major mainstream commercial style.
That's right.
From this. Because it came into R&B, it came into rock and roll, it came into soul, it came into hip-hop. Even country musicians would be bending
right.
their notes.
Absolutely.
Even if you listen to that record that Louis Armstrong made with Jimmy Rogers in the 20s, even the country musicians were learning for this. So this is what I find interesting, is there was an amazing moment in which people learned to get out of this mathematical grid. Hey, I no longer have to hit the note right dead in the center. I no longer have to play the beat right dead in the center. I have all this freedom. And then all the computerized music tools, it was so much easier to go back. I mean, conceivably, software can do all those things. It can bend notes. But the easiest thing for software to do is that precision.
That's right.
And so I fear that we've lost something. It took us 100 years to break out of this Pythagorean paradigm, I call it. It took us 100 years to break out of that paradigm, and I'm worried that we have lost that, and we need something new to shake us up so everything isn't just driven by mathematics.
So you talked about the first time sheet music sold a million copies. Oh, Susanna, the Maple Leaf Rag. These were ways that, you know, historically musicians made money. Until people were able to write things down and you could print them and sell them, there was really, other than being somewhere and getting paid to play, there were no other ways to make money through music, make a living through music.
Musicians have always struggled to find a way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're dealing with is something that's intangible.
Yeah.
And I've found over the years that if you can turn your creative product into a physical object, it's easier to sell. The worst example, I have a wife is a dancer. How do you monetize a dance? I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's hard to monetize a dance because it's a moment in time.
That's right.
It's an experience. And music is like that, too. I mean, it's an experience. How do you put the experience in a bottle? And so musicians have always struggled, and I've found at points in history when they've managed to turn what they do into a physical object, all of a sudden they can make money.
Yep.
Around the year 1600 again, and maybe a little bit before, you just had the birth of music publishing, where finally you could publish your music in a book and sell it. But I've studied this, and it was interesting. Most of the first music books that were published only sold about 500 copies. The print runs were 500 or 1,000. And often the composer had to subsidize it. So it was like okay. Today. You know?
Right. Going, oh, no difference.
I've been there, done that. You
right.
know? But finally, at some point during the 19th century, this changed. Oh, Susanna by Stephen Foster sold a bunch of copies, although people immediately tried to pirate it. The Maple Leaf Rag allegedly sold 1 million copies, which seems impossible because I can't imagine there were 1 million people that could play that piece.
That's right.
And I played that piece in the piano. That's a technically, but at least they bought the sheet music, and that's the beauty. That's the beauty when you turn into a physical product. It's like me, I write books. I get paid the royalty when they buy the book. I don't have to wait till they read it. So that, you know, that's a,
right.
You know, I had to wait till they read it, you know. But the, one of the problems we've had now is that during the course of the 20th century, musicians made a lot of money turning their music into physical objects, not just sheet music. Then it became records and compact discs and cassette tapes.
Yeah.
And that disappeared over the last couple decades. It's coming back now. It's coming back in a bizarre way, these non-fungible tokens, these NFTs.
I was just going to ask you about that.
And I find the whole idea bizarre because you make more money selling you turn your song into a non-fungible token and you make a small number of copies, maybe even only one. You can make more money selling that NFT to one person.
To one person that you can.
Than to share your music with
conceivably,
millions.
Conceivably, that's right.
And okay, I've got mixed feelings. On the one hand, I'm happy about this, and I do believe musicians can make money selling non-fungible tokens. I've been studying this.
Okay.
And as bizarre as this is, it is a way to make money, and there are musicians out there that are bringing an income that they never had before,
yep.
turning their music into an NFT. But I am troubled, once again, by a culture in which you can make more money selling to one wealthy collector than sharing your music with millions of people. So I do believe we need, that's why I'm such a big thing on this super vinyl or anything
yes.
that gives a musician a chance to sell something more than a t-shirt at the gig.
Right.
I'm completely in favor of it. And not just, okay, obviously I'm pro musician, but I also think this is for the fan too.
Absolutely.
I don't think that the musicians and the fans have adversarial relationships. I really believe if I get the fan excited by my music, we both benefit in that. So yes, the sheet music was a forerunner of this, but we need something like that now for, you know, the digital age. And there are things out there, but I still don't think we've found the final solution. I have all sorts of crazy ideas. I have this article called Strange Predictions About NFTs. I actually think we could have a situation in which you sell your music to a fan and they actually end up with an ownership stake in it, so that if they can get more fans for you, they make money, and it's all going through a blockchain, and you don't need to trust your manager or the record label anymore.
Right.
And ways to create financial incentives so that both the fan and the musician both benefit financially from the success of the song. It's not happening now, but I believe within 5 years it will be, and those kind of relationships could be truly transformative.
So these Web3 applications, the NFTs and things like that, could be concert tickets, could be fan club access.
Sure.
So you think within 5 years that people, because it takes a long time for people to adopt
yeah.
things, right?
Yeah.
Even like a debit card. You know, people used to use cash all the time. Now people went to debit cards, and people rarely use cash. I can't remember the last time I.
No.
You know, people are like, oh, you're paying in cash? What? No. It's an odd thing. And somebody needs to have an account, you know, with cryptocurrency or something like that, and then they have to get used to having that, and they have to get used to buying this and buying that, and it takes adoption of these things takes years for people to feel comfortable that they understand what it is.
Yeah.
And is that 5 years or is that 20 years? What do you think?
Well, there's an adoption curve, and I've actually studied this. You know, I used to study with Everett Rogers, the guy who actually invented the study of how innovations go viral. And I've even studied the mathematics of it, and there's certain these S-shaped curves, and there's an inflection point
mm-hmm.
where something starts to take off.
Yep.
And I don't think we will reach huge adoption in 5 years, but I think we may hit that inflection curve where it starts to accelerate rapidly. There's a moment where 20% of people in America had radios, and then a moment where the 80% did.
Yep.
And it seemed to take forever to get to that 20%, but once you get to a certain point, it accelerates. The internet was like that, too. There was a period where very few people had online access, and then over a period of 5 years, it just took off. I do believe there are going to be completely new ways of consuming music, probably involving a blockchain of some sort. And it's going to be more than just these silly collectibles. It's going to be a genuinely transformative way of financing your album and sharing the rewards with your fans. And there's so many people that are doing startups in this, and there's so many smart people.
Yeah.
Some of the smartest people in the world right now are working on this specific issue. Now, when is it going to go super mainstream? Well, once it's proven itself, that will happen faster than people realize.
All right, we're back. It's 8:56 p.m. We made it to another podcast of the Abolitionist Hour. And we didn't finish with that song, but we will follow up with Mr. DOG and Hilltop Crips, our good friends out in Tacoma, Washington. And Hilltop is where the old port was of Tacoma. So we've talked about the old Hoovervilles and the shanty towns and things like that, and so there was a radical labor force there at Hilltop back in the day. And I didn't make it to Edna St. Vincent Millay again. My apologies to Edna. But I do have some great Tony Williams jazz quintet on the intro of that Edna St. Vincent. So I found a nice site on YouTube. It was the Fuji Jazz Festival, Mount Fuji. And just top shelf acts and recordings and just a bootlegger's dream. And so check out the Eric King interview on Unicorn Riot Ninja, or you can find it on It's Going Down. And it's interesting. It's hard to believe it's been about almost 4 years that they transferred him from the Core Civic in Leavenworth to Florence, Kansas, or not Florence, Kansas, Florence, Colorado, and then after his court date, they sent him out to Lee, Virginia, the federal prison in Lee, Virginia, and that trip to get him there had to have taken at least a week. So it's basically moving from a third party contractor. Transports prisoners, and they can only stop at county jails, so prisoners get restroom breaks and lunch and that sort of thing. And it's this network of these confluence of routes that they transport these prisoners on in, and it's just there's so much. It's so expensive. It's unbelievably expensive. I don't think.